From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1987. That was around the time that MTV viewers started to wonder, hey, is MTV playing fewer music videos? What's going on here? Well, here's what was going on. MTV's ratings had been declining, and a man named Jarl Mohn had an idea. After consulting with others and researching audience habits, it turned out that the music video was a bit of a problem for MTV. So Mohn proposed cutting back on videos, emphasizing a new kind of programming. It even included a game show called Remote Control. Remember that? And by now you know, Jarl Mohn was right. The game show was a smash hit. MTV broadened its programming, telling stories. That is just one example of the rather bold, occasionally risky decisions that Jarl Mohn has made throughout a career that's taken him from hosting radio programming to television executive work, helping create the E! Network, for example. Well, in July of 2014, Jarl Mohn was chosen to lead NPR as its president and CEO, the fifth CEO in 6 years, but he appears to be bringing stability even while he brings some change. Today, Jarl Mohn's in Rochester visiting WXXI. We're thrilled that he's taking the time to join us on Connections. Welcome. Great to see you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I've been told that I do a pretty strong impression of our CEO, Norm Silverstein. I'm going to save that for another day. I've also been told you do a spot on Ira Glass. I wonder, do you do the whole arsenal of NPR voices?
No, maybe I should develop that. I just did the Ira Glass thing for a speech we were doing. And people seem to like it.
I love the fact that you come in with this background of work across the broadcast spectrum and a lifelong, or at least for many, many years, as I understand it, an NPR listener, mm-hmm. but a fresh perspective. And the question of change can be hard. Status quo is always easier. Mm-hmm. I wonder what it was like at MTV when you raised the idea of maybe this music video thing is actually hurting us.
It was painful. And it was even painful for me because my background up to that point was in music radio. And, you know, I loved the music video form. And so it was a wrenching decision, but it was a decision that had to be made.
And it was certainly the right one. And now here you are in NPR. And maybe it's not the same as cutting back on music videos for MTV, but you came in after listening to NPR for years and had the opportunity starting in July of 2014 to start changing some of the landscape. What are some of the most significant changes that you would mark in your first year?
Well, the first is kind of a more of a behind-the-scenes thing. The good news is for NPR, and one of the things that we're so happy about is that, you know, the content and the news for so long has been really well done. And so the editorial, while there are some changes that we're making, for the most part, extremely well done, great storytelling, great news department. The biggest things we've addressed are really business issues. The organization's lost a lot of money for the last 6 years. This year, there'll be a surplus, so we've turned the finances around through the great work of this management team that we've put together. So it's more behind-the-scenes stuff.
You use the phrase secret sauce mm-hmm. when you talk about the essence to building an audience is not just to abandon a story because it's difficult or dense or feels like broccoli when everyone wants dessert.
Yeah.
It's great storytelling. And I think of Planet Money did a story about where does your shirt come from
mm-hmm.
and the entire process that goes into it. And they did a tremendous job, step by step, of telling the story of one shirt. I thought that was an amazing example that distilled it in a very memorable way. What are some of the things that stand out to you? What are the kind of programming that immediately stands out at NPR on NPR right now when you think that's great storytelling?
Well, that's the essence and I think the secret sauce of what public radio and what NPR does when we do what we do well. As so many in journalism, whether it's television, broadcast television, whether it's cable television, whether it's radio, people have a lot of news organizations have moved away from telling some stories because they don't test well, or it's a tough story, or it's a hard story to tell. And they go, well, we need to tell it, but let's edit it down. Let's do a 30-second. We really think we have a mandate to cover these stories. But the way to do it is to make them engaging and to make them interesting. Some people think, well, that means you're dumbing them down. And I would say absolutely not. The intention is not to dumb them down. It is to make it engaging so people want to understand more about it. So whether it's the T-shirt story that you're talking about with Planet Money or one that is dealing with something far more important, which was the series they did on the subprime mortgage meltdown,
yes.
The most important story for perhaps certainly 5 years, maybe a decade, in its impact on everyone's life. A very complicated story. You start explaining CDO, CLOs, tranches of financing, you know, banks, investment banks. That, they did 2 hours on it. 2 hours. And they made it fascinating and riveting. And to me, if we can do that with the most important stories of the day, that is really great. Then I think we will have accomplished something very important.
I feel like their great storytelling starts at the bottom. It starts with one person, or one T-shirt, or one mortgage that they shouldn't have gotten, as opposed to saying, here's how the tranche system works, and here's what A is, and B level, and C level, and here's how they slice up toxic mortgages and hide them in these financial instruments. They started at the bottom, and I'm thrilled to hear that you come into the organization and say, that's a value for us. We're not dumbing it down, because don't you think NPR listeners would recoil if you tried dumbing it down?
Oh, they would run away. Our audience, I mean, they're thoughtful, they're intelligent, they're deeply engaged in their communities, they're deeply interested in what's going on in the world around them. They don't just want news. News can also be, by the way, and this is not a criticism of other news organizations, because there's some that do this remarkably well. News can be a commodity business. If you're just talking about the facts, this happened, then this happened, then this happened. A lot of people can do that, and with the internet, that information is disseminated widely very quickly. So what do you do to differentiate yourself? The answer is provide context. Explain what it means. Do some analysis on it. Break it down to talk about how it affects individual people's lives or the lives of individual communities. That's really, I think, providing something extra that others don't do. And I think that's what we attempt to do. That's what we aspire to do.
My guest is Yoram Mohn, president and CEO of NPR since July of 2014. And joining Connections today because he's in Rochester this week. He really has this peripatetic schedule where you've been visiting your affiliates across the country more than I've ever seen an NPR executive. Why are you doing that?
Well, first, the goals that we have for NPR, I can't get accomplished if I don't have the support from the member stations. I grew up in radio. I spent 19 years in the business. I love radio. I love radio stations. I love local radio. And every time I take a trip like this to Rochester and I visit a local radio station like WXXI, I learn a lot of things. I get great ideas. Someone just moments ago was telling me just an idea. It's more of a behind-the-scenes thing that we can do in providing value to NPR stations across the country. I've always told, I told the board when they hired me, I told my management team, if you see me in my office, behind my desk, worry.
Well, it is nice to see a face in person, and I know
you.
We appreciate it here. I came from a career in commercial television news. You know that world just probably as well as anybody, and I don't miss it for a lot of reasons, but here is one immediate reason that comes to mind. I recall, this was probably in 2002 or 3, working for the 11 o'clock news, and a consultant came in, as they are wont to do, to tell you everything you were doing wrong. And we were told that we needed to have at least 30 stories in the 11 o'clock news. Now, a half-hour newscast, of which were probably 9 minutes of actual news. And I started to think, and I said, wait a second, we only have about 9 minutes of news. And the consultant said to me at this meeting, don't do the math, just do your job. And I remember thinking, but the math says, how many seconds do we get for a story here?
Yeah.
And the opposite is true at NPR, where you're the mandate from Jarl and the executives and the team in charge of these stories is we trust great storytelling, even if it's 2 hours on Planet Money or 6 minutes for a story on All Things Considered or whatever it takes. Can you tell me a little bit more about your feelings about the length of stories?
Length of story is irrelevant. It has to do with how good is the storytelling and how much time and how much in the way of resources do we have to be able to tell the story. We do 8-minute pieces. We do 4-minute pieces. And, you know, even historically at NPR, there weren't room for it. Interestingly, there wasn't room for a small story. And some stories just don't merit a long story so that they didn't get covered. We tell the producers and the writers and the correspondents, if you have a minute and 30-second story and that's what you need to tell the story, tell it in that. If you need 8 minutes, take 8 minutes. And if you need 2 hours, if you're going to do two one-hour podcasts, that's fine too. The beauty of podcasts is you're not even confined to a 30 or 60-minute format. If you want to do a 17-minute podcast, you can do a 17-minute podcast. So we're trying to say, make the story that you're doing be the determining factor on the length, whether it's 90 seconds or whether it's 4 minutes or it's 8 minutes.
Why do you think news consultants, especially on the commercial side, don't trust viewers and listeners to engage for a long time with a single story?
Well, in defense of them, and I don't like to defend them.
Sure.
They have a job. Their job is they have to get ratings up so the commercial television station can make money. And it's almost like a best, although I hesitate to use the word best practices. I'm going to put quotes around the word best. But things that have worked for other stations, let's not cover tough, important issues like what's going on at city council or with the Board of Education, because those stories are boring. Let's do fires. Let's do crime. Let's do, in L.A., where I'm from, car chases.
Right.
And so the consultants will really gravitate to that because that's what gets ratings. And they're being hired to do that. And so I understand why, you know, commercial television kind of gravitates that way. It's sad, but, you know, I try to look for the silver lining in everything. The silver lining on that is it just creates more of an opportunity for us in public media and in public radio to provide really good quality journalism, because not everybody wants the fire or the crime story. They want to know what's going on. And for that type of listener or that type of consumer, that type of user, that's what, you know, NPR and public radio is for.
We occasionally get a car chase. It's usually when someone is visiting Rochester from L.A. That's generally what we have. We're talking to Yoram Mohn, the CEO and president of NPR, who is in Rochester and giving us a few minutes of his time. You opened the door to an important subject that you have been very willing to discuss, which is the fact that your number one job is to make sure NPR is stable financially, mm-hmm. growing a donor base, and even in the early days, I say early days, July 2014, but coming in and being willing to try to engage with your affiliates, even when some of the affiliates might have been thinking, wait a second here, is this a zero-sum game? Are some of our big donors going to become NPR donors? Are we going to lose them? And you've sent a message that we haven't yet tapped the potential and that we can grow it for everybody. But for those who are nervous about that, because we want to succeed at WXXI and WEOS mm-hmm. and the Finger Lakes and all of these affiliates, what's your message for growing that kind of base?
Well, you've outlined it beautifully. We really think together we can raise a lot more money. We can tell a much more compelling story, because the real benefit, the real success locally for NPR and the stations that perform the best are those that weave together what we provide with international and national news and our explanatory journalism, and they tie it seamlessly with what's going on regionally and locally. And the stations that do that really perform extremely well. And when we tell the story to supporters, people that love listening to public radio, whether it's, you know, listening to NPR or WXXI, being able to support that unified mission, I think, really resonates with a lot of people. And it's a bigger story. It's a bigger story for us, because we're now adding in that regional and local element that really touches their lives and the communities that they live in. And similarly, I think it reaches out beyond what's happening locally. And so a lot of local donors, knowing we have 17 international bureaus, so we're covering stories from all around the world. We've won all sorts of major awards this year on our coverage of Ebola. I think that resonates, and it creates a bigger story. So we are, and my mission, and one of the reasons I'm spending all this time visiting local radio stations is, you know, trying to reassure them and tell them how much we want to work with them. We think there's so much upside, and that the quality, you know, the experience for people listening, the people listening right now to WXXI, is going to be so much better over the next couple of years, because you folks are going to have the tools and the resources to do even better local journalism while everyone else in the area is cutting back.
I have mentioned on this program before that I think back to the late 1990s, and we've had discussions over whether it was inevitable with the advent of the internet that the news-consuming public would start to expect things for free. And I don't, maybe that is somewhat inevitable, but I wonder if you could go back to 1997, 98, 99, would the Times and the Post follow the Wall Street Journal and put up a paywall and say, we can't give you content for free? Was that a mistake? And has that affected the landscape now? Or was it inevitable that this new sort of media landscape was going to force all of us to come up with new ways to reach people to make money.
You know, I've thought about that an awful lot, and I really don't know the answer. The Wall Street Journal has been able to put up a paywall and do it successfully because of the kind of proprietary information that they have. The New York Times is an amazing publication. They do great work. They do great journalism. But because of that issue that you're talking about, that it's available other places, are they going to be able to create a successful paywall? I have no idea. I do think that public radio and NPR and WXXI have an opportunity because of the unique nature of what we do. We are offering it free all the time anyway. You don't have to pay for it if you don't want to. It is voluntary. It's always been voluntary, whether it's being a donor or a member. And I think as long as we do our jobs well and provide great journalism, whether it's local and regional here or with us, international and national, and tell these stories in a really compelling way, and other people are not doing it, there is going to be a segment of our society and our listeners and our users that really find great value and are going to be willing to support that and be very, very worried that it's going to go away if it's not supported.
Yeah, I that's why I think now in 2015, working for this kind of an organization, this is a model that feels like it is sustainable. I mean, you've got to work to convince people to become donors, and something like 90% of the people listening to us right now are not donors. But I was told coming in the door 18 months ago, Yarrow, they said, "You're fired up. I know you're happy to be here. Do not shame people for not giving." So is Mark Gruby around? If he's not around, I'm not here to shame anybody. What message do you take? How do you toe that line? Because I've had friends tell me, and we're going to talk to one of the longtime friends of WXXI and a longtime board member later this hour, who has often said that if you listen to WXXI and you don't become a member, that's like walking down the street, seeing a newspaper stand, grabbing the Democrat and Chronicle and taking off running. Mm-hmm. I don't view it quite that way, but how do you send the message?
Well, I think the better job we do at NPR and the better job you do at WXXI, and we're providing real value to people, 100% aren't going to support us. Right now, it's roughly, 10%?
Something like 10, yeah.
You know, if we get it to 15 or 20%, that is a major win. And I think we can by just telling better stories and not shaming people. We don't want to do that. But letting them see the value of what they're getting and the fact that it's just not available anywhere else. And also igniting the passion. For some people, it's science reporting. For some people, it's reporting about the economy. For some people, it's reporting about education. For some people, it's about health. For some people, it's international coverage. Everybody has a certain area of interest. And I think the secret to philanthropy, whether it's for an art museum or whether it's public radio or whether it's a hospital or whether it's an educational institution, is really finding what a person's passion is and letting them know, showing them how their support really helps an organization. We have, I think, public radio in general just hasn't done over the years a great job of connecting individual passions with donors, and I think we have a great opportunity there. So that's one of the reasons I travel around.
And how is the health of NPR financially right now, maybe today and compared to July of 2014, especially in context of the broader media landscape, or whether it's the BBC or other big organizations that we know and love? We have seen plenty of cutbacks in recent years. How's NPR?
Well, we had a series of difficulties that preceded me. I've really lucky. We have a magnificent management team. And because of the work they've done this past year, we had 6 years of losses, roughly anywhere from $4, $5, $6, $7 million a year. This year, our fiscal year ends September 30th. We will end the year with a slight surplus after 6 years of losses. So it's stable. We still have a lot of challenges. We have a lot of work to do. I have to remind everybody internally, hey, we're just beginning. You know, just because we had one good year doesn't mean it's done. And I like to use the analogy of playing a video game. You know, when you win a video game, all you really win is the right to play the next highest level of the video game. And that's what we've done. Now we're going to have to play a tougher game.
Got a few more minutes with Yarrow Mohn, the CEO and president of NPR. By my count, was 5 and 6 years, and you've either stabilized it or you're nearing the end of your tenure based on recent. I think you've stabilized it, and you've told the story that throughout your career, you've had success, and folks have come to you and said, "We think this is a great fit. We'd love you to do this. We'd love you to come in," whether it was E Network, MTV, so many other places. Mm-hmm. This was a job that you had to say, think about me.
Mm-hmm.
Why? You did not have to do this.
No, I did. Well, I wasn't working. I wasn't working for other people. I kind of semi-retired, although really it was hardly a retirement, when I was 50. And the statement I made to the trades at that time was, working full-time for other people is highly overrated. And it got translated over time to people said, working is overrated. And I said, no, it's not what I said. And so I was working for myself for 12 years, didn't need a job, didn't want a job. But I love public radio. I think it is such a national treasure. I love NPR. I love what public radio is doing in communities all across the country. And I was concerned because of this turnover. So this is a mission for me. It's not a job. You know, I'm not getting rich on this job. I'm putting in ridiculous hours. I spend all my time on airplanes visiting cities. It's a grind, but it means a lot to me. And it's the most, I've done a lot of stuff over the years. And a lot of really, people say, is it fun? I said, well, you know, I've had some really fun jobs in my career. I've done some really fun stuff. The bar for fun for me is very, very high. But I would tell you it's the most satisfying job I've ever had. I've never gotten so much personal satisfaction out of doing anything as I have this.
So you'll be here for a while, you think?
I will be. I made a commitment to the board. I made a commitment to the management team. I'm making a commitment to the member stations and the people that support public radio. I will be here a minimum of 5 years. And in a lot of other institutions or organizations, that doesn't sound like a lot. But given, you mentioned, five CEOs, if you count the interim CEOs, I'm number 8 in 9 years. The eighth CEO, including the interim CEOs in 9 years. That's not good for the organization. We have to have stability. So whether people are going to agree with everything I'm doing or not, we're going to provide financial stability, management stability. We hired some great people. I mean, I've got a remarkable management team that are doing great, great things that I count on. They're the ones that are making the key decisions, not me.
Can't let you go without asking a little bit about podcasting.
Sure.
And you've spoken about just the blank canvas as a medium, that it can be a 17-minute story, it could be 6, it could be 51, it could be 2 hours. NPR has had such success with podcasting. How do you view it? Well, let me back it up and ask you first. What do you listen to? What podcast do you like to listen to?
Well, there are those that I listen to regularly because they're habits for me, like This American Life, which is not ours, but I think it's remarkable. I love Ira Glass. I think he's a great storyteller, and I think he's kind of, in many ways, kind of invented or reinvented the medium. But I listen to a number of programs that are broadcast shows that I listen to as podcasts. I listen to a lot of Fresh Air that way. I really love Terry Gross. What else do I listen to a podcast? I love Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, most of which I hear on the radio, mm-hmm, though. Mm-hmm. But there are so many. And then I try to listen to new things to see if there are new ideas and new great storytellers out there that we need to get involved with. We launched Invisibilia this year. I thought, they did an amazing job.
Yes.
I think that's a great one. And that's going to come back. And we're launching a new one with Shankar called The Hidden Brain. And I think that's going to be a remarkable podcast as well. It's an exciting time.
It gives great storytellers such room.
Yeah.
How significant a part of the future is it?
It's hard to tell. No one really knows. If you were to take the temperature today, you'd say it's going to be massive. And I think it has the potential to be massive. But I also think it's going to have a great impact just on broadcast, on terrestrial radio, and the way we tell stories. There's been this mythology, you heard me talk about it earlier today, that to reach an audience, regardless of the age anymore, you talked about commercial television, shorter stories, faster paced, glitzier, don't do anything really important, just talk about, lifestyle and feature type stories. And podcasting has really shown us remarkably and very dramatically that all those things are wrong. You can be thoughtful, you can be smart, it doesn't have to be super polished. It can be more informal. And people, if it's good storytelling and it's got a great narrative, will stay with it. I think that will impact the way we sound at public radio. So I think it'll be hugely impactful as a form itself, as podcasting. And it makes sense that that's going to prevail because we're in an on-demand world. We're watching more and more television on demand. you know, the notion that you have to set your you have to check your watch or the clock because this show is going to be on at 3 o'clock. You can't miss it. There are certain things that are going to be much more appropriate, like the news magazines. What's happening in the world right this minute? You don't want to listen 2 days from now. Why would you want to listen to All Things Considered 2 days later? You don't. You should listen to it at the time that it's broadcast. But there are a lot of other things that people are going to want on demand, and that's what podcasting is.
All right. Finally, our listeners would want to know if there are any changes that you haven't revealed yet that you'd like to break on this program, or at least give us sort of a lens. We've seen some mild changes to All Things Considered. We've seen more of an emphasis on promoting Morning Edition, but anything that stands out to you that our listeners would be either excited about or curious to hear about that will be coming down the pike in a few months?
Well, I think the changes that people are going to hear are going to be probably incremental changes for the most part, because what NPR has been doing, I think, has been really, from a content standpoint, really good. The journalism has been first rate, and I think is only going to get better. Won 75 major awards in the last 6 months, a Peabody Award, 2 DuPont Awards, 2 Edward R. Murrow Awards. Great news gathering, great explanatory fact-based journalism. But I think what people will notice that's different is we're going to try to take these very important stories and make sure that they're much more engaging, and just improve our storytelling, because that's the way more people will. You know, it's those notorious and famous driveway moments that people talk about with mm-hmm. public radio. And the more of those driveway moments we have, the more of those moments where people can't get out of the car or can't turn off their, their iPhone if they're listening to a podcast because they're so completely engaged in the story. That to me, that's the mark of success. That's when we know we've done what we're supposed to do really well.
It's been great having you here.
Thank you for having me.
And let me risk speaking for my colleagues at this station when I say that. Since you came to NPR, it feels more like a cohesive family across the country, affiliate to affiliate, and with the parent network, and we look forward to a great relationship for years to come. Thank you.
That's kind of you to say. Thank you.
We'll take a short break, come back, and we're going to sit down with our friend Tom Proietti, the resident scholar in media at St. John Fisher College, get a little reaction to what we just heard from NPR CEO, and talk about the future of public radio next. Coming up in our second hour, debating the merits of televised debates. Do they still matter? Do they help the electorate? Do they solve anything? We saw the first televised debate of the presidential campaign last Thursday night on Fox News when 10 Republican contenders took the stage in Cleveland. What did we learn, if anything? Should we stop doing debates or change formats? It's all next hour.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
10 years after Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans has recovered in many ways, except crime. This year, the city's murder rate is on the rise.
The increase is coming from domestic violence-related homicides, arguments between people that have turned fatal, and robberies that have turned fatal.
Crime in the Big Easy, with not-so-easy answers later, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tom Proietti is the resident scholar in media at St. John Fisher College and a longtime member of WXXI. He's one of the big cash cow donors that Jarl's after, right?
Yeah, right. He's at my house right now. Yeah, shaking down my wife. Yeah, exactly.
It's great to have you. And I just want to start in general talking about some of your reactions to what you just heard from NPR's president and CEO, who didn't send a delegation, didn't send a representative. He himself, Jarl Mohn, is traveling to these affiliates across the country. What did you just hear?
That's amazing. What I heard is just amazing. I mean, he's obviously a gifted leader, somebody who really understands how to build a management team, how to take an organic structure and make sure that it wasn't healthy before, and he's in the process of returning it to health. And for most listeners, we never detected any of the illness, but the illness was 8 different CEOs in 9 years, including the interim people. That's never, ever good for an organization. And you could tell just by the things that he had to say. First off, he's not patronizing. Secondly, he's not apologetic either. And he knows where the strengths are, and he knows where the weaknesses are, and he obviously has put together a great management team that knows how to support him and maybe even short-circuit him so that we keep moving in the right direction. And then I think one of the interesting things is he knows the relationship between local stations and National Public Radio. National Public Radio is not the link to the to me. The link to me, for the most part, as a listener, is WXXI. This is the really important brand. And he knows there's an NPR brand. He knows there's a WXXI brand. He knows there's an Evan Dawson brand. There's a Connections brand. He understands those things thoroughly and completely. And he also knows that the future is going to be really difficult in maintaining those brands because it just gets more and more complicated every day.
Well, Tom, I really wanted to ask you about Yarrow Moen's background, because there are some NPR listeners who may not know anything about him, might not know the name, but then they find out he was at MTV, he created the E! Network, and some people will say, wow, this is a man with a remarkable track record of success. Others might say, wait a second, that MTV and E! Don't feel like journalism, and is that the right background to lead the network? Look, I'm not saying it as an indictment. I'm simply reflecting what I'm hearing from listeners. Most listeners are really satisfied with the product, satisfied with these subtle changes that aren't wholesale. But what do you say about a background like that?
I say he's a marketing person. He's somebody who absolutely understands the target audience. And no matter what the target audience is, whether it's for E, MTV, or NPR, he understands how to get there and how to create a product that's compelling and that generates loyalty. I mean, one of the most important things about NPR and about any brand is brand loyalty. The Toyota people are rolling their graves right now because I traded my Toyota in and got a Mazda. And that's problematic. And the same is true with all these brands. So he obviously understands marketing. He understands the target audience. And he understands not just how to get them there, too, and how to create the product that delivers them, but then how to keep them, how to engage them. He wouldn't be here. I mean, this is such a tribute to this guy. He's here to engage. He's here to pick up new ideas. I heard him walking up the hall, and he said, I've picked up about 5 great new ideas here today. The guy's an idea factory. Plus, he started long time ago, as I did, and maybe even you did. I think you did in college radio.
I did.
We were disc jockeys. What's a disc jockey do? You play music because you hope to attract an audience.
Yep.
You don't play the music you necessarily like. You play what they want to hear. And that's like the first step in media content, is saying, well, you know what? What I have to say may not be the most important thing, but I may be able to deliver the thing.
Is that why no one listened to me
from
midnight to 7 a.m.?
Were you playing that trash that you like?
I did.
Oh, in a Gata DeVita? That's why they weren't listening.
I thought I was the paragon of taste. Are you kidding?
And see, that is a problem between people who know marketing and people who don't know marketing. The people who know marketing will somehow or other package the thing together so that even if you don't like it, you're probably going to stick around because they put the package together in the right way. And at some point, they're delivering content to you that, it was compelling. It's engaging. I can't turn off NPR. I absolutely cannot turn off NPR. The only thing that I can do that's probably different than a lot of listeners, and this is where NPR faces a dilemma in the future, and local stations especially do, is I have 3 internet radios, and I have Sirius and XM in my house. If something comes on WXXI that I don't want to listen to, I'm off to something else that's also NPR delivered on another platform from another delivery service and never has the WXXI call letters inside of it and doesn't make me feel like I'm getting anything back for the contribution that I make every month to XXI. So that's where the tricky future is going to come in, is how do I keep me brand loyal to WXXI and brand loyal to NPR and brand loyal to the entire fabric of what we call, this non-commercial venture. And it's not just radio either. If I listen to NPR, I also realize I want to hear promos for what's going to be on Frontline. I want to know what's going on here.
It's funny you say that, because this morning at a private meeting here at WXXI with the staff here, Yarrow Moen said that he gets into the job of CEO in July of 2014, and the first thing that someone said to him was, you're going to lead NPR? That's great. I love Downton Abbey.
See, and that's a plus and a minus.
Yes.
Both. That's, you know, it's understanding that there's a very large brand that's non-commercial. That's PBS. You know, it's the public broadcasting system.
Yeah,
PBS,
so for us, it is WXXI, yeah. But it's not NPR.
And, no.
But that shows the conflation that the public might have with public media. So,
and
good,
over here,
so good and bad, you're saying.
Yeah, and over here we have the, you know, the great advantage and disadvantage of having an AM station and a couple of FM stations and, you know, an FM station that plays classical, another FM station that's kind of jockeying around and is identified with the University of Rochester and WEOS. I mean, we have all so many things, and we have Reach Out Radio. There's so many things plugging in together that are doing a lot of interesting and different things. So even at this level, you have to develop a brand and brand loyalty that's really sensitive to your audience, because that's the real key. So that when you come back to me, or every month, in essence, I vote that I want to continue to support this operation. Now, for me, 90% of my vote is radio. It's AM radio, too. You know, I put a little Facebook picture up today. It's 1370, and I'm thinking probably 60% of the audience doesn't even know what 1370 AM means. You know, they're getting it from some other platform, but that's fantastic. You know, we listened to you last week using the XXI mobile app, you know, riding through Massachusetts, and I was able to listen to Connections on WXXI.
Well, here are some numbers that Jarl Scherl shared with us this morning, and this was a number that put a hop in my step. Certainly, because we know that millennials, maybe even Generation X, but millennials are listening to less sort of terrestrial radio.
Right.
But here is the good news. According to Jarl Mohn this morning, 94% of adults listened to some terrestrial radio in the last week.
Yep.
93% of millennials listened to some terrestrial radio. Now, millennials are listening to less terrestrial radio
right.
than older adults. But if 93% of millennials are listening to the radio in some form, the radio isn't going away tomorrow.
Not at all.
So there's still a chance to bring people into your sphere if you are giving them compelling storytelling, good content.
Yes. And one of the real keys that Jarl recognized, I think like the first week he was on the job, I remember hearing him speak on the Diane Rehm show, is he said he was really concerned about the decrease in time spent listening to national public radio and to the local stations. And that's a real key in our business, is I have to keep you engaged. I have to keep you here so that when Connections goes off and we go into Here and Now, it's got to be, I've got to keep you there. If you're flipping off to something else, you know, I'm probably making a mistake. You're coming, you know, you come on right after the Diane Rehm show. That's a great lead-in, but if we were losing people because of that, I don't think we are. In fact, I think the audience gets bigger when you come on. Yeah, that's a real advantage, and that's a form of brand loyalty that's really consistent. And one of the things he also said in the preceding half hour was this thing about there are certain things we want you to listen to at exactly that time. There are certain things, you know, it's like a sporting event. If the Buffalo Bills are on a Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock, I don't want to watch it at 5 o'clock on a DVR and skip through. You know, the whole world just passed me by. So sporting events, that's one thing. I want to listen to All Things Considered as the world unveils, as it comes apart. I actually like listening to Connections that way too. But what I also find is that as a podcast, I listen to Connections frequently when I'm walking on a treadmill.
Well, and that's very nice of you.
But I listen the second time because I get more things out of it the second time. The first time I'm thinking, what should I say and what should I be sending you a tweet or should I be calling into the show? And I never call into the show. Evan knows I tweet almost every show.
Or if you're really fired up, you text me.
I text them. That's right. Yeah, every once in a while. That's the key to this. It's engagement. It's passion. It's the fact that I really want to be here. And there are thousands of people in this community who are passionate about this place, the way they're not passionate about any other media platform in this town. And you guys are the envy of everything that's going on in the media. I love hearing my commercial colleagues, some of whom are really good friends, who call this welfare radio, or public assistance radio, because they still think the federal government's giving it a ton of money. And there was a time when that happened. You know, now the government forms of money, not just feds, the state, the locals, whatever, I think it's down to about 30% of everything that's given. If it was all taken away.
Here, I think it's less than that.
Or maybe
it was like
less
24
than that.
Cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
It's a lot less.
But it used to be like 97%.
Mitt Romney did not help. This is not a comment on Mitt Romney's politics, but he did not help the public understanding
no.
of just how much help we do or do not get from
right.
government sources.
Right. And you know, and to a lot of people, this appears to be an entitlement. And it needed seed money to get up and running, and that was what the government did. That 1967, one of the great things Lyndon Johnson did was create the CPB, sign it into law, and he was a commercial broadcaster. He actually owned commercial stations. And he understood this was the enemy, but he also understood if we didn't start developing something that was kind of like the BBC, that was insulated, that wasn't full of advertising, we really had to do it. And I think if Lyndon Johnson were alive today, he'd be very, very proud of the child that was born.
Talking to Tom Proietti, who is the resident scholar in media at St. John Fisher College, longtime local professor, a friend of WXXI, and we're talking about the future of public media. Earlier this hour, we had a chance to sit down with NPR's president and CEO, Jarl Mohn, who is in Rochester for a few days, not only visiting WXXI, listening, sort of collecting ideas and trying to build this relationship from affiliate to affiliate and affiliate to parent company. I think he's doing a very, very good job of that. And let me peel back the curtain a little bit and tell a story that might be a little inside baseball, but I do think a lot of our listeners like to hear about, some of the inner workings that you might not see. And here's a story that I think indicates how savvy Jarl Mohn is. He came in to NPR in July of 2014, and Morning Edition's ratings have been going down about 8% a year for about the last 5 years. That doesn't mean it would have been down 40% cumulatively. It was 8% but regardless, a lot of different programs. It's not a commentary on the quality of Morning Edition. It's commentary on, are you building an audience? Are you reaching new people? Are you effectively promoting what you're doing? So Morning Edition had seen some issues there, and Jarl Mohn said, well, look, I'm looking around what we're doing, and we never promote Morning Edition on other shows. And he asked why. And a lot of the affiliates told him, well, we can't run a promo of David Greene saying tomorrow morning on Morning Edition because there is some local programming, and we might be utilizing that time block for local programming. Therefore, we can't risk that. And Jarl Mohn said, well, essentially, sure you can. There's certain programming that, you should commit to, and also you should promote yourself more. So he left it up to the affiliates, said, if you get on board with this, let's see what happens. And he said he expected 20 or 30% of affiliates to get on board with this new promotional schedule for Morning Edition. 90% got on board. For the 90% that got on board, Morning Edition's ratings were up 4%. First time they were up in a number of years. And for the 10% that didn't, the ratings were down more than 20%.
Yes.
So just alerting people as to what's coming up was enough for people to say, wait a second, I want to be there. And here's the long story short, and Tom's going to go too late. The long story short of this is Jarl Mohn knew that just promoting is not enough. You have to do it in a way that is not obstreperous. You have to do it in a way that doesn't make the NPR listener feel like, well, you're gouging into my coverage. It's a 15-second promo once an hour, but it's compelling, it's crisp, it maybe includes a brief soundbite, and it makes me say, boy, tomorrow morning when I'm driving to work, I know what I'm listening to. And look what he has done, Tom.
It's no different than going to the service department for your car. I take my car, my Mazda, to Eid Mazda, and they do a great job. And they're it's a promotion. It's constant. They ask me if I like the car, and this is what we did. But that's part of the relationship. He also, if you think about what he did, is he brought over the commercial model where they promote like crazy. Now they promote to the point where it's
I think it's over the top.
Ad nauseum. Yeah, it's like it just doesn't stop. I love watching the Ellen Show, but then the local TV station that runs Ellen locally teases like crazy during the show.
We call them tease casts.
And they're tease casts, exactly. and they just drive me right through the wall to the point where I don't want to watch the story. It has just the opposite effect. What we need here is we need to know that there's a much larger picture than any individual program. There's a much larger collection or cast of characters than any individual person. It's really this big thing called NPR and this big operation over here called WXXI, and that's the thing I want to be brand loyal to. And, Evan Dawson's a real big part of that, and Beth is part of that, and Alex is part of that, and Randy's part of that. Those are absolutely critically important kinds of things. But there are also times when I really need to pull the whole thing together and say, you know what, you have to support WXXI. And sometimes you have to reach in your pocket to do that. And
did you hear us talk about shaming?
Yeah.
I was thinking about you.
I'm the shamer, yes.
You are the shamer.
I'm a shameless shamer. I have no apologies for letting the 90% who don't contribute let them know that they're freeloaders. That's my take. Well, they are. They're freeloaders.
Do I have to edit this out of this portion?
No. If they want to keep this service, if they're brand loyal to it, it doesn't cost that much. It costs less. You could do it for less than one Starbucks a week, and just $10 a month. You know, would make all the difference in the world. Because at some point, all those membership drives that we do, we're not going to even be hearing those things. Because they're going to be coming in from some, I'm going to be coming in from a platform where I don't hear those membership drives, or I'm going to be listening to it as a podcast, no membership drive. As I said, I listen to internet radio. One of my favorite stations is KQED out of San Francisco, and even their podcast, as soon as you their internet live stream. Is sponsored by a mattress company called BioMattress.
Underwritten.
Yes, right. And you're right. But you know what it's about.
Yes.
Wow, that's fantastic. And the first thing the sponsor said was, "You better make sure that stream hooks up in less than 2 seconds." Well, anybody who ever does any streaming online, if you have an internet radio, you know that some stations take 20 seconds to hook up because they have to go through all this buffering, and KQED hooks up in about a second and a half. And it works. So these are the little kinds of things that we're going to have to be playing games with. And he also mentioned, you both mentioned podcasts. Mm-hmm. Connections as a podcast is fantastic. It's something we never did before.
Here is one place that I feel much more at ease. For anybody who heard that Yarrow Moen was going to be the CEO of NPR, and by the way, he created the E-Network, and he was a big part of the change in programming at MTV, and he used to be a disc jockey and all of these things, and you're looking for the journalism hat. Here's what I learned from Yarrow Moen. He is a big journalism person, but he also knows that it wasn't his career.
Right.
So he hired some remarkably talented people from journalism, decades-long careers in the Associated Press.
Yep.
He elevated people within the company with real journalistic chops because he has the self-awareness to say, this is a value. Everything starts with great journalism. We're going to turn it into better storytelling.
Yes,
we're going to turn great journalism into better storytelling.
Right.
But great journalism is at the core, and I'm going to bring in people. It's
right. It's
the kind of boss. It's like a head coach in football who says, I'm not an offensive coordinator. I'm going to hire the best one I can find,
absolutely,
as opposed to saying I'm going to call the plays.
That's a great analogy, too. That works perfectly. Now, one of the things I'm going to grill him about this afternoon, I hope I get a chance to say this, too, is I sometimes, when I'm listening to all of our media in the United States, but NPR I'm going to hold especially responsible, is I sometimes feel like Scandinavia doesn't exist, that Spain exists, but Greece doesn't exist, and Italy doesn't exist at all.
Well, Greece exists when the country breaks.
Yeah, well, and, I hear Joanna Kakikas comes on, and, she's on for a while. But Lauren Frere is over in Spain. She must be somebody's cousin at NPR because she gets all this airplay, and if you know how the game works, she's making money off of this, and most of those are not major news stories to me, but she was all over the news this morning, and I don't really give a hoot about that story that she was talking about. Australia doesn't exist. Central America doesn't exist. South America doesn't exist. We're missing a major part of what's going on in the world, and in essence, I think this news organization has to be smarter than the United States government, because the United States government is spending all their time right now in the Mideast with ISIS, with the Iran deal, and we're missing what's going on in 99% of the world by concentrating on this, this little geographic area that's relatively small. Maybe the size of the Great Lakes if you put them all together. And we're missing a lot of the world, and I think NPR can do better. It's expensive to do that. Well, guess what? I'll up the ante of my personal giving, and I think other people will too. If you start covering Brazil or Argentina, or every once in a while mention Uruguay, I'd like to know that they're there, and let me know what's going on in Costa Rica, because there are a lot of things going on there, and we're missing them.
Before I let Tom Peretti go, and again, he's the resident scholar in media at St. John Fisher College, he brought up podcasts. I will say that, number one, it's a great pleasure to hear of the many listeners who do listen to this program on a podcast. Maybe you're listening to this on a podcast right now. Someone sent me a note last summer that said, Connections podcasts are my beach reading. I said, that is the best endorsement. Isn't that great? That is.
I remember the day you said it.
I wanted to put that in a bronze plaque on the door. I mean, that's fantastic. But we're going to be doing even more. As we expand what we're doing with Connections, we're going to be sort of aiming for a different length and sort of a content model. So that will be coming. I can't say more about that yet, but that's going to be coming. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, so I may get off the air and get in trouble for saying this, but my colleague Veronica Volk is one of the really, really well-engaged people with podcasts, with the future of media platforms. She is already working on a number of projects that are so exciting that will be coming. and that this is a company that is really thinking seriously about that. So my last question to you, Tom, is this, and there's no answer for this, so this is a blank
canvas.
I
have an answer for everything.
Well, you do have an answer for everything. But, you know, when the world was going to digital cameras, Kodak went to Kodachrome film, saying, hey, this is the next thing.
Mama, don't take my Kodachrome away.
And they heard crickets, and they're going, huh? Anybody? Anybody? Kodachrome? How does a media company, whether it's NPR, WXXI, commercial television, whoever it is, how do you figure out where the audience is going platform-wise before it goes there or as it's going there so you don't feel like you wake up in 5 or 10 years and say, everybody's gone?
Get them engaged. I mean, it's the essence is engagement. And if you have X level of engagement that's coming from iPad listeners or podcast listeners or whatever the platform they're coming from, if you have that and you all of a sudden see it slip, it went someplace else. Or worse yet, it maybe disappeared. So you have to keep these people engaged. More and more than ever, we need people to give us feedback. We have all the mechanisms to do that, and we're not doing it very well at this point. Social media, the Twitter is kind of static. Facebook, fairly well done. But, you know, we just really need a lot more of the interaction, and it has to come from both sides. And for most of us, this is the Wild West. We don't really know the rules, and a lot of us are afraid that we're going to get shot in the back or get an arrow in our back. It's a tricky, tricky arrangement. And I think you also need people who are on the outside. Bring them inside every once in a while. Do the focus group and ask them, where are you listening to us? Why are you listening to us? Are you time shifting us at all? Are you listening to internet radio? Are you going to KQED because you don't want to listen to something that's on XXI AM? And it takes an awful lot of interaction, a lot of research, a lot of effort. There's nothing that's going to come easy out of this.
Thank you, Tom. Great talking to you.
My pleasure.
And my thanks to Tom Peretti, and my thanks to Yarl Mohn, NPR's president and CEO, who gave us so much of his time earlier this hour. Short break and more connections next.